You're listening to Talking to the Max with your host, Gary Max, here on J-Air 87.8 FM.
And good morning. It's the 7th of March. Best time of the year in Melbourne. Beautiful weather. Fantastic. And, of course, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at In One Voice. So that's the first thing I want to explore today. And what could be better than talking about In One Voices? I mean, we've talked about the music, and the music sounds fantastic, and we've talked about some of the stalls that are going to be there. But what's the most important thing? What's more important even than music? And it's got to be the food. And today I have food critic Danny Valent with us, and she can be talking about all the food that you're going to be able to taste in about a week and a half's time down in Selwyn Street. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming in. So, and by the way, Danny, just as background, is, well, she's the food critic for The Age.
The Sunday
Age. The Sunday
And I know there's some Indian Jewish cooks doing doing something. I'm not even sure what they're doing, but it's going to be fascinating. There's a cake competition, so people need to bake their cakes and enter that, and that's going to be judged by Pierrick Boyer, who's an incredible local patissier. And I'll be doing my spin on matzo balls, which is
it's good timing.
You've got to be careful to mess with the classics, because I know that a lot of people think that, you know, don't change perfection. But I'm just going to I'm always inspired by multicultural Melbourne, so I'm planning to bring in a few different flavours to the matzo balls.
Really?
Yes, I know. Don't. I know you're looking a little concerned. So.
No, not at all. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, so not saying there's anything wrong with the classics, but I'm just going to give it my little spin. And I'll also be making it in the Thermomix, which is my sort of cooking specialty.
I was going to say, I've noticed in the literature about you that you're obsessed not just with food, but using the Thermomix.
Yeah.
I haven't been introduced to it yet.
Okay.
Although I know one of my daughters is absolutely obsessed with it as well.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, she's got to check out my website.
Everything with it.
Okay. Well, that's a great thing about it.
Except
is that
to drive the kids to school. But yeah.
Yeah. If only you could just put wheels on it. It could probably do that too. Look, it's just a fun tool. So I wouldn't really consider myself a gadget person who's obsessed with the latest machines. But I have found that Thermomix is just an amazing helper in the kitchen that lets me do all kinds of different things, from making stock pastes to flavour my food, to milling grains from scratch, baking bread, creating salads. And, of course, now, matzo balls.
Matzo balls.
Yeah.
So what's the secret ingredient in matzo balls that you're going to...
Well, I'm not going to spill all the secrets, and I'm still developing the recipe, which is very fun. So one of the most fun parts of what I do is test the recipes and, just keep tweaking them and, I guess, working out which direction I want to take them in. But I am thinking a few Vietnamese flavours.
Mm.
So I'm thinking a little bit of lemongrass, bit of Vietnamese mint. Because I think, you know, if you think about Vietnamese soup, you do have – it's very herby.
Mm.
And I know some people put parsley in their matzo balls, maybe a little bit of dill sometimes, but I'm going to take it in a slightly different direction. But I think, staying true to the spirit – if not the actual construction.
So long as it's halakhically acceptable, it'll be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not going to break any of those rules. So I think it'll be really fun. I'm also going to, rather than starting with matzo meal, I'm going to make my own matzo meal from matzo so I can have the different textures that I want.
Is that a Thermomix thing as
well? Yeah, that's going to Thermomix thing
that,
where you can...
That gets done in the Thermomix too.
Definitely, yeah. Wow. So you can definitely mill things and get the textures that you want, which I really love being able to sort of fine-tune my cooking to that degree.
Mm.
So, yeah. I feel like it lets me be more creative, which is really fun, because I just love mucking around and experimenting in the kitchen.
Yeah. So what else is going to be on show food-wise?
I don't even know. Like, I think
there'll
there's
be a whole lot of tents there.
There's
going
to be some deliciousness. I'm sure there's going to be great smells. There's going to be street food to eat. There's lots of food trucks coming, I believe.
Mm.
But it's all the information's on the In One Voice website. And if you just make sure you're looking at the Nosh tent section, then you'll be able to see the timetables and all that extra info. But I know that it's all free and it's going to be really vibrant. And as you said, it's the best time of year in Melbourne. So what better thing to do than wander around eating delicious things?
It sounds really great. So how does someone so obsessed and intrigued with food stay slim? How do we have a healthy diet as well as, you know, trying all these fantastic things?
Well, look, to me it's all about balance. So I do go for jogs with my dog. And I've got her in the car, and I'm going to head over to Caulfield Park when I leave here, and we'll do a lap.
The corner.
Exactly. Yeah, found her a spot in the shade. I definitely, you know, run to eat. I would rather exercise more than eat less.
Yeah.
So that's, I suppose, my approach.
A happy balance.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I eat, because as my job as a restaurant critic, I'm eating out a lot. So
That's really what I was going to ask.
Yeah. So I'm definitely a clear your plate kind of gal as well. So some critics I know are able to just taste something and then move on to the next. But I hate sending a plate back to the kitchen I think the chef feel a bit sad if they
that's
see
right.
you haven't, especially if it's, you know it's delicious, so I just want to eat it. So I suppose then it's about moderation the next day, or, you know, not having, making sure I just, you know, sort of have nibbles during the day, and then I'm able to really experience the full pleasures of the restaurant in the evening.
Do restaurateurs know you're there to test their food when you go?
Well, I don't announce myself, and if it's a place where you need to reserve, I book under a different name.
Right.
So then my trick is remembering what name I've booked under, I have gone awry at that point. So I review all different sorts of restaurants for the Sunday Age. So it might be cafes, it might be sort of ethnic restaurants in the suburbs, and it might be the more fine dining restaurants.
Mm.
So the fine dining places, I would say, are somewhat attuned to critics, and that there might be, you know, people that have been in the industry for a long time. So I'd say, yes, sometimes I'm recognised in those kinds of places. But if I'm at a, you know, Indian restaurant out in Dandenong, that sort of thing is just like not on their radar.
Yeah.
So I'm able to just slide in and have a normal experience. But writing for The Age, you know, we always pay for our own meals. And so it's like you're just a normal customer. You're not in there trying to be lord
of the
manor.
Radar.
Yeah, you try to be as unobtrusive as possible and just have a regular experience.
And what happens if you write something that they don't like? What sort of hate mail do you get?
I suppose I'm pretty glass half full. So my perspective is more trying to lead the readers to a great experience.
Yeah.
So I'm not about slamming restaurants. But, of course, sometimes you do have to temper that optimism with some reality. So if the restaurant is dreadful, then I may choose not to write about it rather than slam it.
Right.
Because you just, I suppose, have to – there's so many good places you could send people to. So why just use those column inches to slam somewhere that I don't think's good. On the other hand, if it's a restaurant that people would have a reasonable expectation of being fabulous, and it might be somewhere that they're choosing to go for their anniversary or a special birthday, then I feel like you do need to let people know that it's perhaps not the restaurant that they thought it was.
Yeah.
So, but I think, you know, accuracy, honesty and integrity are sort of the things that you try for, and any restaurant can have a bad night. So I'm not about slamming places that, you know, spill the soup or someone makes a mistake. But I think I'm also very conscious of how restaurants deal with those things, and that can be just as telling as the original error.
Yeah. Now, we go there for the food and the service, sort of are the two major ingredients in the experience. How do you as a critic balance those things?
Oh, look, honestly, I think the food is obviously important, but I think it's the service that makes an experience.
Mm.
So there are, you know, I think bad service can ruin good food.
Yeah.
And great service can turn mediocre food, you know, you remember the experience rather than the food. So it's crucial.
It is.
And
I find a lot, you know, in my own little shopping centre near where I live, there's a whole lot of cafes opening up all the time. And the experience varies enormously.
Absolutely.
Because there are managers who know how to treat staff, how to treat customers and staff.
Yeah.
And there are ones that clearly don't. They're just sort of poking around in the dark. Their shops become empty pretty quickly.
Look, I know, because we're very you know, we judge pretty harshly in Melbourne.
Do.
There are so many choices that you just don't need to go back to somewhere where you didn't have
God,
a good
it's
experience.
Amazing.
It's
the
amazing.
The number of restaurants and cafes that keep on opening
I know.
It's just
Yeah.
unbelievable.
But it does, you are pointing to an issue that's quite big in hospitality, which is finding staff. So that's not only front of house, but also in the kitchens. It's a massive issue to find people that have that level of expertise. But also, I think it's that that ability to notice what customers need. And I think that's almost more important than any skills as such, is that intuition and that empathy with just anticipating needs and noticing what needs to be done.
A natural character.
Yeah, I think it's hard to train that.
A naturally communicative sort of person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I guess a manager's, part of a manager's job is to train people in that too.
Absolutely. But it's so, I think that's probably the hardest thing to train for, that empathy. Because then it's like, if you notice something, then you can definitely train someone to what to do about it. But to actually, I don't know, it's that awareness that I think, you know, if you walk in somewhere and you can tell that they're onto it, they know what's happening at every table, they've noticed you, then you're instantly at ease.
My entrees come 20 minutes before somebody else's or something like that. And all that, those things all happen.
I know, and it stresses you out as a diner.
It does.
Because you want everything to go well.
It does, and you know you won't go back.
That's right. Yeah, very important.
I mean, there's a cafe in near where I live. They opened up a while ago, put a lot of money into putting this restaurant together, and it just didn't work. It just didn't work. I don't know why. There's this great big cavern. This guy had a reputation. Nothing happened. And then it got taken over by someone who's done, it's his fifth restaurant or something, and the place is just jumping.
Yeah, it's amazing.
The staff are fantastic. The food's good. I think one of the most important ingredients, the coffee's good.
Got to be good.
Got to be good in Melbourne, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I know my mum is brutal about coffee. So she only has probably one coffee a day. It's got to be good. And if someone doesn't come through, she's not going back. She's telling her friends as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's absolutely crucial.
Exactly. Any other Pesach recipes you can share with us quickly? Because it is that time of the year.
Oh, look, I just go with the classics, and I love my family recipes, but I also just always dip in at this time of year to Claudia Rodin's beautiful cookbook, which goes through all the holiday recipes. So, I like to try something different every year. But I mean, I don't know. Love the flourless cakes, so sometimes it's not always the traditionals, but I do a love cake, so a sort of Persian inspired cake, beautiful nutmeg through it, and just so that's a bit of a favorite at any time of year, but it's good to roll it out.
Absolutely. And I guess, do you cook I mean one of the problems we have is Ashkenazi versus Sephardi recipes for Pesach time. Do you dabble on both sides there?
Yeah, look, honestly, my family's, we've got influences from all over, and we're not super strict about anything. So, I feel I've got license to play, which I love. I think it's, sometimes I think when we've got restrictions around food, it actually makes it really fun. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the journeys that happened in my family was when my sister became a vegetarian at the age of 10, and my mum became incredibly creative. So she was already a really good cook, but it just makes you think differently about, what are we going to do and make things delicious, even working with these restrictions? And I think that's one of the opportunities of Pesach, where, we're cooking differently, but I think we can use that as an opportunity to be creative as well as to connect with those beautiful old stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
She's still vegetarian?
No. Oh, yes, she is. Yeah, she is. We all dabble. Oh, I also was vegetarian for a while. But it doesn't really fit well with food writing.
No, it's pretty difficult to go and critique restaurants if you're a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Even worse if you're a vegan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it gets easier these days, but even so, you've got to give a rounded picture.
Absolutely. I'd noticed, by the way, some time ago, there are quite a few African restaurants on the other side of town.
Kensington and Flemington around there. Yeah.
It's a whole new world too, by the way. When you walk down those shopping centres, it's not like any other part of Melbourne.
Yeah.
And some of those food smells are just fantastic.
Yeah, it's really beautiful, honest food. A great thing about Somali food that I learned recently is that you always have a banana with the meal. Mm. So they'll give you a banana with the main course.
Really?
Yeah, and you just have to, you eat it. Well, it's not your dessert, it's you eat it with the main course. Yeah, it's really cool.
Wow.
Yeah. Somali's one of the biggest banana producers in the world.
Well, I've learned something new.
Yeah. See, that's what I love about food, is that you always can learn something new. There's always new things,
and it brings people together. So let's just recap. We're talking about the Nosh Tent on the 18th of March, which is only a week and a half away.
I know, it's so exciting.
Yeah,
yeah,
and that's going to be going all day.
I think all afternoon. I think I'm on it around 1 o'clock. But can I also mention a couple of other events I've got coming up? So I'm doing a cooking class next Wednesday evening, a Thermomix-related cooking class all around autumn inspirations. And on March 29, I'm doing a cocktail party. So that's going to be really fun. And that's just in Rip and Lee at a new place called Turning Point. So I would love anyone to come along to either of those events. And the tickets are at my website, dannyvallant.com/shop, and you'll find all the details there. So, yeah, I'd love – I mean, Nosh Tent is going to be amazing. I cannot wait to be there, and my other events are going to be fun as well.
Can you leave us with any interesting, different recipe?
Oh, that's a tricky one.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but.
Well, you have put me on the spot. So I've told you about my mutch balls with Vietnamese flavours. So I'm hoping that the talkback line is going to light up with outrage. I'm not sure. And the Persian love cake is just a beautiful, obviously a flourless cake full of spices. And pistachios and all those kinds of things. Yeah, I'm just going to give you those. You can find other recipes. Go to your Claudia Rodin. But that's the ones that I'm most excited
Thank you very much. And don't forget, everybody, on the 18th to get down to Selwyn Street, listen to the music and eat all the food, because it's going to be great fun. And you're going to learn a lot about cooking too, something a little bit different too at the Nosh Tent. It's going to be great fun.
It's going to be a great day.
Everybody get down there. I'm going to try an experiment. I've never tried to do this before, but I'm trying to play a bit of music from the CD player here, which I've never done before, so I'm learning some technical skills. Let's see if this works.
You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful. With a workday window blowing, I've got nothing to do but watch the passers-by. Mirrored in their faces, I see frustration growing, and they don't see it showing. Why do I? You got to get up every morning with a smile. Beautiful as you feel. I have often asked myself the reason for the sadness in a world where tears are just a lullaby. If there's any answer, maybe love can end the madness. Maybe not, oh, but we can only try. You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful. You're beautiful. You're beautiful as you feel. A
wonderful Carole King. And, of course, the reason I played that is, if anybody hasn't got noticed yet, there is a show on in town called Beautiful, and it is the Carole King story. Carole Klein, as she actually was before she became Carole King, the music writer and performer. I'd like to just focus again, something I touched on last week, but I'd like to touch on again, and that's Poland's Holocaust law. And there was an article by one of my favourite journalists in Israel, Daniel Gordis, during the week, and he writes the following: that Poland's Holocaust law is all too familiar to Israelis. Students visiting concentration camps get a fresh reminder of what anti-Jewish sentiment looks like. The class trip to Poland is a high school highlight for many Israelis. Although not mandated by the government, it has become a widespread rite of passage. Touring Warsaw and Krakow affords students an opportunity to learn about the grandeur of Jewish life in Poland before it was eradicated. Seeing the death camps at Auschwitz, Birkenau, Sobibor or Treblinka serves as a chilling reminder of the Holocaust and an opportunity to appreciate the drastic change in the Jewish existential condition that Israel has wrought. Not all Israelis are fans of the trip. Some parents remain opposed to funneling money to the Polish economy. Others assert that if the Israeli educational system needs trips to death camps to inculcate in its students a commitment to Zionism, something is terribly amiss. By and large, though, Israelis acknowledge the power of these tours, and thousands of teenagers participate each year. So, too, do Israeli soldiers. The IDF regularly sends delegations of officers to Poland. The highlight is often marching into Auschwitz, wearing Israeli uniforms in the very place where almost a million helpless Jewish victims were murdered. Diplomatically, Israel and Poland have long had cordial relations, with Israel increasingly worried about the erosion of American support in the long run. A Pew Center report recently showed that most Democrats are more sympathetic to Palestinians than they are to Israelis. And given Israel's isolation in Europe, Israel has been anxious to maintain those relations, even in the face of Poland's move to the nationalist right. A new Polish law, however, has suddenly battered the relationship. It criminalizes suggestions that Poland was complicit in the Holocaust. Although the Poles are correct that they were not entirely free actors during the war, the country was invaded by Germany and later by Russia, the claim that there were not some who were intimately, even enthusiastically, involved in the slaughter of Jews is a horrific distortion of history. The Israeli response has been vociferously critical. As the law was under debate, Israeli Education Minister Naftali Bennett announced that he would visit Poland and meet with students and Polish officials to express Israel's strong opposition to the bill. I am determined to clearly say that history has already confirmed that the Polish people had a proven involvement in the murder of Jews during the Holocaust, he said. I am going to speak truth where the truth took place, and it is not dependent on any law. The Polish government would have none of it and cancelled Bennett's trip. Escalating the war of words, Bennett then sent a photo of himself next to Auschwitz and insisted that he saw the cancellation as a badge of honour. The blood of Polish Jews cries from the ground, and no law will silence it, he later said. The government of Poland cancelled my visit because I mentioned the crimes of its people. I am honoured. Whatever Poland's affront to history or Jewish sensibilities, Israel would swallow its pride, however, and seek to minimise damage to its diplomatic position. Bennett insisted that the visits of Israeli students would continue. The government announced that it might hold a summit to which the Polish Prime Minister would be invited. But Poland was not done. With the tumult over the Holocaust bill far from over, lawmakers began exploring legislation that would criminalize the kosher slaughter of meat. The country also froze progress on a Holocaust survivors' property restitution bill. Israel's Hebrew Press reported that Prime Minister Matuz Morawiecki had visited a memorial to the Holy Cross Brigade, which is known to have collaborated with the Nazis. He also commented this month, in response to a question from an Israeli journalist about the concentration camp law, that, quote, "We do not deny the fact that there were Polish perpetrators as well as there were Jewish perpetrators or Ukrainian perpetrators. For many Jewish observers, this comment was beyond abhorrent. It was clear that Poland was awash with a new wave of government-sanctioned anti-Semitic sentiment." Noah Landau, a senior journalist for Israel's left-leaning Haaretz newspaper, tweeted that it was an outrageous scene at the security conference in Germany where Morawiecki made his remarks after the Prime Minister compared Polish perpetrators in the Holocaust to Jewish perpetrators. The audience, Europe's elite, stays politely quiet. Landau's point was that it's not only Poland that hasn't changed since World War II. Europe's response remains horrifyingly recognisable. Israelis who feared that Jews might forget Europe's hate-filled legacy can now rest assured. For the foreseeable future, Poland itself is ensuring that will not happen. It's rather frightening to see the lurch to the right and the rekindling of that anti-Semitic fervour that was in Poland and Eastern Europe before the war and during, of course, during the war. And another article which I think is quite amazing on this, the first lawsuit filed under new Polish Holocaust law. A Polish campaign group has filed the first legal action under the new Polish Holocaust law that criminalises any suggestion that Poland took part in crimes against the Jewish people during World War II. The Polish League Against Defamation is suing Argentina's Pagina 12 daily newspaper for using a photograph of Polish soldiers who fought against communists after the war to illustrate an article on the Jedwabne pogrom of 1941. In which Nazis and local Poles massacred at least 340 Jews. So there we are. The new law is already being used. A very sad note in Polish-Jewish relations. Another piece of music in the meantime.
You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful as you feel. Waiting at the station with a workday window blowing, I've got nothing to do but watch the passers-by. I see frustration growing and they don't see it showing. Why do I? You got to get up every morning with a smile on your face and show the world all the love in your heart. Then people gonna treat you better. You're gonna find, yes you will, that you're beautiful.
Better, you're gonna So more of Carole King singing about beautiful. And as I said, at the moment we have on in town the show Beautiful, which is about Carole King, or Carole Klein as she was known before she became a songwriter. Joining me this morning is Rabbi Fred Morgan from the Progressive Jewish Organization. Good morning, Fred, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Gary.
Now, I was interested particularly in a letter that was in the Jewish News last week, which was about the nomenclature for the progressive movement. And we know that originally in Australia it was known as the Liberal Movement, and then we had a Liberal Party form itself. So I think that was probably part of the reason for the name change here in Australia to Progressive, which is a term that's been used elsewhere in the world. And, of course, in America we use the word reform. So how are we going to address this apparent confusion in terminology?
Yeah, it's pretty complicated, isn't it?
It is.
The use of adjectives to define Judaism really goes back a couple of hundred years to Europe, and it depends where people came from in Europe, what term was adopted in England or in other parts of Europe or in America. So in America, they called it reform.
Mm-hmm.
In England, they tended to call it liberal. That's a Germanic usage.
Yeah.
Reform, I think, is more Austro-Hungarian usage. But basically, they typified the same phenomenon, which was an attempt to bring a modern outlook into conversation with traditional Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So it would attract Jewish people whose attention otherwise was wandering off into other domains.
Okay.
And Orthodox, in fact, was that title, that name, is really a reaction to reform.
And this all arose, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, probably in Germany, in the sort of mid 1800s.
Yeah, Germany and Hungary mainly.
Yeah.
Slightly differently, and the original reformers, so to speak, were in fact highly educated, yeshiva educated men who wanted to acknowledge the Haskalah, the growth of the Enlightenment, and the use of reason in relation to religion. So they wrote their original books as responses in the very traditional style, always in Hebrew. And then various rabbis who opposed these changes wrote their responses also in Hebrew, and that's how the debate began. And in order to define themselves, the different groups had to take on different titles. So in Britain, for example, today, you've got two different movements, the British Reform Movement,
right,
which is actually more like the conservative movement in America, and that grew indigenously in Britain out of the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue. The original Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in Britain was in Bevis Marks Lane in the city of London, and various Jews were moving out to the West, and they asked if they could start up their own little minion out in the West because it was too far to walk on Shabbat to get to the main synagogue. And the elders of the synagogue, in their wisdom, said no. So these people in the West did what any Jewish group would do. They founded their own.
They started their own community.
Yeah, they broke away. And they called it the the Synagogue of British Reform Jews. And that's how it began, as a reform movement. So that has nothing to do with the American reform movement. And the Australian liberal, reform, progressive movement, whatever word you want to use, is also very much indigenous to this country. I mean, it brought traditions from both Britain and America, but it also has its own style, which tends to be more conservative than what you find in lots of other parts of the world. So conservative with a small c, that is, a lowercase c.
Yeah.
So the names change, but the what's really important is what goes on in the synagogues, not, you know, the name of Yiddish.
Well, yeah.
We took on progressive because precisely because people were identifying us too strongly with either the American Reform Movement or the British Liberal Movement,
mm-hmm.
neither of which really capture the spirit of Australian progressive Judaism. So when I came about 20 years ago, we started using the word progressive in place of the other two names, which have been used previously.
Right.
And little did I know that the name progressive was going to be taken up by a whole political movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of my
direction again.
That's one of my main issues, I guess, with the naming is, and you know, there's a show on this radio station that happens on another day, and it's called Nothing Left because its views are quite conservative. So, and they often talk about, well, progressive Jews think this and progressive Jews do that, and they don't actually mean people who are affiliated with the progressive synagogues. They mean people's political views. So is there actually, but it's an interesting question, what sort of difference is there actually between progressive views and progressive Judaism?
Okay, so first of all, I have to say, we had the name first, and I know the people who do the Nothing Left show.
Yeah.
And it really does get to me sometimes. It's quite annoying when they take that name and then use it pejoratively. The progressive in Judaism really means a state of mind,
yeah,
or an attitude. So the attitude is one that says that it really matters that we live in a modern world. We can learn a great deal from the advancements in science and technology and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That Judaism, it's more important that Judaism stay alive and stay vibrant in people's hearts by adopting some of these features of the modern world and allowing Judaism to grow through them rather than keeping it in a totally pre-modern state. So that's really a way of looking at Judaism, and that's what we mean by progressive. So I often speak about progressive Orthodox,
right?
You know, who are people in the Orthodox movement who are completely progressive in their outlook and their understanding of the modern world and the values that we can gain from it. But they happen to be Orthodox socially in terms of synagogue affiliation and so forth. And I also speak about Orthodox progressive Jews.
Right.
That is, progressive Jews who don't have that attitude of change, allowing change to occur. So their progressive Judaism, the way it was done 70 years ago, is the way it should be done today, and
yep,
that's the end of it. Very traditionalist.
Which a lot of us today call modern Orthodox.
Modern Orthodox tends to be quite progressive.
Yeah,
in that it allows for change. That's probably the key. That it recognizes that there have been a lot of advancements in our understanding of human behavior, of the value of other human beings, and what we should be doing to create a better world. You know, Tikkun Olam is a very important value,
mm-hmm.
Mending a broken world.
Mending the world.
Yeah, and so modern Orthodox does tend to be quite progressive in that sense. But when I use the word that way, I don't mean it's a political stance.
No,
affiliation.
I understand that, I think that's probably where the difficulty arises, isn't it? Because I mean, Orthodox Judaism, be it you know, from ultra Orthodox through to what we just talked about, modern Orthodox, it still is governed by the halacha of old, and whereas progressive liberal, even reform are terms, terminology that are laced with politics, certainly in today's times and probably over the last, you know, 7 or 8 decades. And I guess that's where the confusion comes from.
Oh, I'm sure that's true.
Because we're not saying that Judaism, there's not a place for progressive Judaism, but just the very term progressive, as we've said, can be used pejoratively by people who are politically conservative. I think that causes a lot of confusion in the community.
It does. I mean, well, one thing that we have to always keep in mind is that synagogues are made up of diverse people who hold all sorts of political views. And so we can't assume that they would agree on actually anything.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly.
Obviously, in any synagogue in this country, we're going to have diehard liberals, we're going to have diehard labor, and we're going to have everything else. Even nowadays, diehard Greens, even though the Green position on Israel is very problematic to many Jews, you still find Jews who are Greens. But that's true right across the board, I'm sure.
So you're touching on a very interesting area here, of course, and that is how political is our religion. Moving all the way from Zionism to Green issues to whatever, you know, freedom of speech. And these are issues that are hotly, as you say, rightly say, hotly debated between Jews.
Oh, absolutely.
Let alone.
But I don't think you can categorize how a person will be politically, where they'll stand, by their synagogue affiliation or their denominational affiliation.
Exactly, and that's one. I would imagine within the progressive synagogue movement in Australia, you would have all colour of politics from. Very conservative to very, as we use the term, progressive.
Yes, indeed. There's the problem right there. And just as you would in the modern Orthodox or virtually any of the religious denominations, you know. So we've got a problem with nomenclature. You're absolutely right. And it would be great to find another term. And people are looking for other terms.
What about modern?
But whatever term they find, eventually it won't fit. Because
that's true. Any term is going to... Yeah, exactly. And over time, things change enormously. But what about modern?
Things change. Yeah. I'm sorry?
What about the word modern? It's not currently a political term.
Modern Judaism.
Yeah.
Yeah, except we live in a postmodern age. Don't we? We have to call it postmodern Judaism. Oh, actually, some people do use the term post-denominational Judaism, which means a Judaism that doesn't attend to these adjectival labels that allows for all Jews to sit equally together in synagogue. But actually, that's the key, that they sit together, that they're egalitarian, and they don't have a mechitza. So I was speaking to someone just yesterday who said the really crucial symbolic difference between Orthodox and progressive is the mechitza.
Yeah.
And I found that a very interesting observation.
It is.
Yeah. Some people have spoken about using the term pluralistic rather than progressive because we do allow for all stances, you know, all positions within Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
In our synagogues, and I think most synagogues nowadays do have a great variety. You'd have to go to Hadas to find a uniform expression of Judaism, I think.
I think that's true.
Yeah, even Chabad is very pluralistic because if you're Jewish, you're allowed to come in and you'll daven the way you're going to daven.
That's right, and there's a great variety there too.
Great variety, yeah. So I think pluralistic has a lot to say for itself in terms of categorizing Judaism today.
Mm.
But I don't think it's the name of a movement within Judaism. I think it's just the way Judaism is. It's more descriptive than anything else, and so I don't think we could change progressive Judaism into pluralistic Judaism. because we're not really saying much if we do that.
Okay. Well,
so I'm stuck with the term progressive.
You are stuck with the term progressive. I was going to say, I'm not sure that we've actually clarified a lot, but I think I think we've certainly looked at some of the reasons behind the nomenclature. Just briefly, quickly, while I've got you on the line, what else is happening in the progressive world in Australia at the moment?
Well, it's very exciting, very vibrant, because our synagogues are experimenting with kind of new expressions of the liturgy, using a lot more music to draw people in. They're expanding their offerings in terms of family services, children-orientated services. They're doing a lot of social action projects, feeding the homeless, working with refugees, that sort of thing.
Right.
There's a lot of work with indigenous communities as well, and just what we call synagogue transformation, being more welcoming to people, letting them know that whoever they are, whatever their positions on all sorts of issues might be, they're welcome to sit together. So it's a very vibrant movement, and we're very excited because in November we're holding our biennial international conference.
Mm-hmm.
That will be in Melbourne.
Oh, right.
At the Novotel. And we've been setting up the program, and we have a magnificent speaker coming, one of the world-renowned scholars in Jewish prayer and also in synagogue transformation. His name is Rabbi Dr. Larry Hoffman from New York City. And so he's coming in November, and we're really gearing up for this. This should be a fantastic conference.
That's great. That's something really to look forward to for us too.
Yeah, there's a lot of life in the movement here.
Fantastic.
Even if we're progressive.
I thank you for our chat this morning. It's been very informative, and hopefully you can join us again from time to time.
Very interesting. Thank you.
And thank you for struggling through your cold.
I'm sure no one would have noticed.
No one would have noticed until I brought it up, so it's just our little secret.
Great.
Thanks very much.
All the best.
All the best to you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
And that was Rabbi Fred Morgan from Emeritus Rabbi Fred Morgan from the Progressive Movement in Melbourne. And look, I just want to finish with one more thing about Poland, one news item about Poland, because I just find this intriguing. A leading, and this is in the JTA overnight, a leading news website in Poland reported that it had obtained documents suggesting that the country's highest officials are not welcome at the White House over a law limiting discourse on World War II. So it's interesting to see how far that's gone. It's having an impact there as well. And I just wanted to finish with one other news item which I found fascinating. I've spoken with rabbis from Rara before. That's the rural rabbis and Purim across Australia, small communities dotted across the vast continent of Australia are little cities, each with its own stunning landscape and small Jewish communities from, you know, maybe five or even one person up to only 70 Jews. So Chabad of Rara has made it their mission to reach every last Jew in Australia, connecting them with their heritage. So Purim saw Rara coordinate events in 12 of the bigger cities, some of them celebrating Purim for the first time ever. And this included Coffs Harbour, the Sunshine Coast, Newcastle, Wollongong, Cairns, Townsville, Geelong, the Blue Mountains, Benalla, Albury, Wodonga, and even Nowra in New South Wales. So it's really nice to see this activity taking Yiddish identity to people who remote from us, but still want to keep that Jewish identity. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. I think we had some really, really interesting things. Don't forget to get down to Selwyn Street on the 18th of March. That's Sunday week. And enjoy the food and the music of In One Voice. It's been my pleasure being with you today, and I'll see you again next week.
J-Air, 87.8 FM.
For analysis and insight into important news about Israel, tune in to The Israel Connection with David Shulberg every Wednesday from 4 till 5 p.m. and repeated on Friday from 1 till 2 p.m. In collaboration with leading figures in Israel's political life, society and culture, you will hear in-depth interviews and discussion concerning Israel. So listen every Wednesday for The Israel Connection on J-Air, proudly sponsored by the United Israel Appeal.
Listen in to Schlepping and Schmoozing with Alex Defner
and Leon Gettler every Thursday at 5 p.m.
We discuss all the week's news and events from Australia
and from around the world, and from Israel and the Jewish world to arts and culture.
It's Schlepping and Schmoozing.
So come join us at 5 p.m. every Thursday.
Shabbat Shalom, with news and events from our community both in Hebrew and English, 3 o'clock Friday afternoons here on J-Air.
The UIA's 2018 campaign promises to be